Welcome to a very special episode of Parallel A Tech Podcast with Accessibility Sprinkles. This is the Relay FM member show. And instead of accessibility sprinkles today, we have some gray sprinkles because we're going to talk nostalgia with some folks who, like me, were around Apple and the Macintosh back in the 90s. And let me introduce my guests. First of all, Mr. Jason Snell, who, if you've ever heard he and I on the same podcast, you've heard about how we worked with each other 20 years ago at Mac User. Hello, Jason.
Hi, Shelley. Yeah, from Foster City to downtown San Francisco. And as I recall, you got out while the getting was good just before they shut the place down.
Just barely, yes.
Yeah, but I was there when they shut the place down in 1997.
Crazy.
So more, that was a long time ago now. That's more than 20 years ago now.
Yeah, this is one of these shows where we have to actually have to admit how long ago things were instead of just fudging them. Whew. So somebody else who was around back in those days, Mr. Andy Anatko. Hello, Andy.
Hello, Shelley.
Welcome. I'm so glad you're here as well. You were not at Mac User as a staffer, but you were a columnist back then. Tell me how you started out at Mac User, Andy. How did you get to be part of this crazy thing?
It's actually how I kind of got started in like big time tech punditry. I was one of the people at the Boston Computer Society who Macintosh Group used to like run the meetings. And we had this thing because back then, if someone was demonstrating a piece of software, we had this overhead projector sort of thing that always would cause the Mac to crash and would almost always create like a 6 to 10 minute delay every time somebody from out of town came up to represent their software, thinking confidently that all they have to do now is boot up this thing and it would never work. So I had this thing where I would set up my Return of the Jedi lunchbox at the front of the auditorium with like pencils and notepaper. And if anybody had questions about like their Macs or things that were going wrong, they should send invitation. Just write them down, put them in the lunchbox. Before the meeting started, I would like take the lunchbox with me and have it like nearby. So if there were one of these six to 40 minute pauses, I would then start like pulling out questions and answering them from the stage just to kill time. And one meeting we had like the editors of Mac User there, and then John Zilber, I think, was there. And then he invited me to lunch like the next day and said that, well, we're looking for like someone. Do you want to write like an article about with the questions that you want to answer? And I wrote that, didn't know that I was trying out for the Mac User Help Folder column gig. And until he told me that I had the Mac User Help Folder column gig. And that's how things started. I remember that it was 1989, because I remember specifically when he told me I had the gig, I thought, that's being the kind of optimist that only someone who is like 20, 21 years old can possibly be, saying that's great, because if I can get them to like not realize I'm a total fraud until January, I can list this on my resume as being a columnist from 1989 through 1990 without necessarily saying we're talking only about 4 or 5 months.
2 whole years.
Wow, that's impressive. So I love stories I don't know the answer. Unlike a lawyer where you're only supposed to ask questions that you know the answer to, I like to ask questions I don't know the precise answer to. So I guess for people who are really youngsters, we should probably go back and lay the landscape of the Macintosh magazines, as I like to say, back when those were things. Back in the day, there was Macworld and there was Mac User. I don't remember exactly when each of them started, but 85, 86.
Macworld first issue was at the Macintosh launch event.
Oh,
they did it
okay.
In advance and printed them and had them there. And Mac User started not long thereafter in the UK, and Ziff Davis licensed the name everywhere else in the world. And I have the first Mac User issue. I think it's 85.
Okay.
I think it's early 85.
Good to know. So I discovered it in 86 when I got my first Mac Plus, and I picked up Macworld and Mac User because I've always been kind of a completist. I was like, I want to read all I possibly can. And I picked up both magazines, and I was instantly drawn to Mac User. And one of the reasons was probably because the first cover that I picked up was a desktop publishing related cover. And that's how I got into the Mac in the first place. And I was like, oh my God, this is amazing. And this magazine is going to tell me everything about how to do this thing. Those were the Mac magazines for quite some time. And there were others that came along later, but there was always like the Mac World versus Mac User competition for quite some time. And I ended up,
oh yeah.
Yeah. And it was, and Mac World was this sort of glossier, shinier version. And Mac User was a little more scrappy, at least just in terms of if you looked at the magazine, and I think the way the magazines thought of themselves, that's the case. You guys just think, sound about right?
Yeah, we were the number two, the scrappy underdog. That was always sort of the way that it was. And it's funny because I didn't know that when I started there, but to take your story and run with it for a minute, my college girlfriend, her dad was a huge Apple fan, and I remember visiting her house at like over Christmas break. I think we drove back from college, and she lived in the Bay Area, and then I got picked up from there to go home up in the foothills, and they had all the Mac magazines. And I had just started getting into the Mac at my college newspaper, and I remember sitting there looking them over and immediately preferring Mac User to Mac World, which was funny because in the end, I ended up working at Mac User because I met Pam Piffner, who was a senior editor at Mac User, and she was teaching a class at the journalism school at UC Berkeley that I was basically one of her TAs for. And she could have worked at Mac User. She could have worked at Mac World somewhere else. I don't even know. It just happened to be the one that was the one I liked, which is why I ended up getting an internship there and ultimately working there. But I do very clearly remember having an affinity for Mac User, probably because it was, yeah, kind of wackier and funnier and more of the underdog kind of thing.
I mean, we had mouse ratings, for God's sake. I mean, little pictures of mice.
True.
So I remember feeling as though I wanted to work there. I'm certain I wouldn't have turned down a job at Macworld. As it happened, I freelanced for Macworld first, and something Andy said reminded me of this, that when I first did freelancing at Macworld, they let me write a feature very early on. I had done some stuff for Mac Week, and they let me write a feature, and I think it was, I can't remember what it was. I think it was about hard drives or something. And I remember the comment from the editor I was working with, who's Galen Grumman. And he said, well, nobody wants to write about hard drives anymore because that's really boring to our regular contributors. And I was young and hungry and wanted to make my name in publishing. I was like, I'll write about hard drives all day long. So I ended up there at Mac User in 1992, having amassed a few clips. And then, yeah, I met Jason when you were an intern back in Foster
Summer
City.
Summer 93.
Yeah.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And you were new on the staff, and the internet was a new thing back then. And by then, Andy, you were like old-timer, right? Were you still writing the help folder by then?
There was an overlap where I was writing both the back page and the help folder, so I don't know which one that was.
So. Come on, you don't remember 25 years ago exactly what you were doing on any given year? Come on, Andy.
No, fortunately, we live in the before times where no one can basically my opinions and my work schedule and my habits up until let's say 2002, 2003 are an absolute blur. thank God, because if someone was able to see, let's take a look at everything that Andy posted on CompuServe or on like his local like Boston message boards, let's just see what he was going through the mind of a 16 through 23, 24 year old kid back then.
Yeah, some things are best left private, I think.
best
no, but nobody wants to see that. Nobody wants to make it easy to find on a search, too. Fortunately, those Mac, or maybe unfortunately, but those Mac User issues and even the old Macworld issues are not, I believe, scanned and indexed in any really easily accessible form, which is probably all for the best. There are some articles I wrote for Macworld sort of like around 2001, 2002 that are still on the web that every now and then I hear from somebody who's like, hey, look, you reviewed the iPod or whatever. It's like, yeah, I did. That was a long time ago now. But most of that stuff is gone. I have a bookshelf with a bunch of old magazines
Same.
In it. I imagine that you guys have the old dead tree stashed away. You know, Andy, I remember, I believe your going to the back page was because Guy Kawasaki, who had been on the back page of Mac User for a long time after leaving Apple, he became an endorser, like a lucrative, like Norton Utilities. Yeah. I don't even remember what it was.
Oh, but right. He was holding up boxes of software. I remember that.
Yeah, yeah. So he endorsed. They did a whole ad campaign where Guy Kawasaki was endorsing a piece of software. And the editors at Mac User, basically, I don't know if that was John Zilber or Mackie Cannon, somewhere in that era, basically said, you can't do that. You can't endorse a product and be our columnist. And so what happened? Macworld said, you can be our columnist. We don't care. And he was the Macworld columnist after that on the back page for a long time. And I think that's when Andy became the back page columnist, if I'm not mistaken.
I thought that the insight and the breathtaking clarity of my words compelled you to do nothing but force out somebody and to make room for him.
We need to make room for Andy. That's right. Force him further back in the back of the book. That's where we want Andy to be.
As I refer to it, I'm like the front page for like Japanese readers.
So what's that like writing a back page column? There's sort of a wide scope of things that you're going to write about. Was that a challenging thing to come up with, or did you have a brief that told you, hey, this is what we'd like you to write about on any given month?
No. I think Jim Bradbury was my editor, and he was great. He was one of those editors who will definitely let you know if you've crossed the line or done something wrong, but he'll wait for you to make that mistake before he'll let you know. I had absolutely no brief but to create do a back page column. I always interpreted that as sort of sometimes I was in sort of like an op-ed page sort of mood. Sometimes I was sort of in a Dave Barry sort of mood. I enjoy the fact if I wanted to just write something that I thought was funny, that was no problem either. But it's also, I really did have the feel the sense of responsibility that this is sort of like the second front page of the magazine. It is like the easiest, it's probably the easiest column to find in the entire magazine. You just peel off the Absolute vodka ad on the back page, and there it is. So I felt as though that was a responsibility to really not just say, okay, well, let's see, I've got my column's due in 3 hours. I'll just see what comes to me. I would often like throw out three or four almost finished columns because it was okay, but it wasn't saying anything that would stand up for like 30 days on people's coffee tables. So it was such a great challenge, and I always had fun every single month.
But at the same time, I think you were hitting your deadlines. Not every columnist, I didn't work with you as an editor, but I worked with a number of other columnists, and some folks were better at hitting their deadlines than others.
I definitely took some inspiration from Douglas Adams. I will definitely admit to that. But yeah, Jim was also good enough to say, let me know when I was bending a deadline and when I was about to break one. And so I made sure that I tried not to bend them. And even when I did, made sure that it was like for an absolutely wonderful reason, as opposed to, you know, I just didn't feel the mood strike me. I need, you know, it's part of my process, which is, I'm sure that
artistic temperament.
I'm sure that that's what you want to hear, like as editors. It's part of my process. I know that you hear a roller coaster behind me on the phone here, but as I'm writing the whip buster, I'm actually assimilating so much of what's happened in the Mac space in the past 3 weeks. Like, no, why don't you? Who was that writer who said? I think it was Neil Gaiman saying the funny thing about the writing muse is that she comes when she hears you typing.
There you go. Mm. So, Jason, you are part of that pipeline from the Berklee School of Journalism to Mac User. Pam Piffner, who you mentioned before, was teaching over there, and you came along, and some other folks did. So when you landed as an intern at Mac User, had it been your dream to be at some sort of Mac magazine, or did you just want to be a generalist journalist, or what was your plan at that time?
I didn't know. When I was the editor of my college newspaper, and then I did an internship my summer after I graduated at the local daily, and I decided that I didn't love the idea that I would not know anything about a story in the morning, and after lunch I would come back and a story I had written would be in the newspaper. Like, I was like, I don't really like how this is a high wire act where you don't know anything, and then, you know, you've got a couple hours to talk to some people and put a story together. Now, ironically, of course, the internet means we're all more than daily newspaper journalists at this point. But at that time, I was less sure about that. I was also interested in TV, and the journalism school at UC Berkeley had a TV program, so I did their first year of their TV program along with their standard kind of journalism stuff. And that was what I like to say about going to Berkeley for journalism school is I had two great things that I got out of it. One of which was I learned I didn't want to do TV. And the other was I met Pam and discovered that there was a way to take the two things I was most interested in, which was journalism and computers, and do one thing, which is write about computers. And I hadn't really thought about it, honestly, as a career path until I met her and I was like, oh, I would love to try that. That might be a lot of fun. And it was a lot of fun. And they you know, the funny thing about the internship is that when it ended, they gave me a couple of freelance assignments that fall, my second year at the journalism school. And I got a job offer in January, so the beginning of my second, my last semester of the graduate program, and for from a tech company. And I mentioned this to Pam, and she was like, wait. And they offered me a job. And so I actually worked at MacUser while I was finishing my master's degree at Berkeley. And so that's when I got hired. I got hired. I started work at the beginning of January of 94 full time, and commuted for the first 5 months or whatever, kind of like between classes going down to Foster City. But yeah, it was not really part of my big picture career plan. But I think if you had looked at the stuff I was interested in and the general career path I was hoping for, I think it would have been understandable. I don't think it was much of a left turn. I think it was more like, oh, you're going to put those two things together now, huh? Because like in high school, or not in high school so much, in college, like I was the editor in chief. I was also like running phone net cables, and so that we could print from the Mac SEs to the big VT600 newspaper. You know, it was a 600 DPI 11x17 tabloid printer that we printed our pages on. And when I got there, you could only print from the Mac 2. And by the time I left, you could print from any of the computers in the office, because we networked the office. And like, so there you go. I was interested in both. And in the end, there was that moment where I said, wait, you could do them both together. And that was a clarifying moment for me career wise.
I certainly had a lot of moments like that before I was at MacUser. I'd been doing freelancing, but I was also for a job a system administrator and was running like 50 Macs. And then at another time, we had a Linotype machine that we were, you know, publishing tabloid publications from. And I wasn't the sole tech support person, but I was the person for whom the editorial staff upstairs, when they didn't want to call the tech guys who were kind of bored and didn't want to talk to them, they would call me and they'd say, Shelley, I can't print. And I would make it possible for them to print. And at some point, I figured out that I could write articles and ended up at MacUser. And that was kind of a dream job. And the nice thing was, once I got to MacUser, they gave me a nice computer and I didn't actually have to do support anymore much. I mean, you know, we all kind of did our own, which was an interesting thing. It wasn't MacUser, even though it was part of Ziff Davis and this corporate entity, they kind of mostly left us alone up until the point that they put Lotus Notes on the network. But I felt kind of, at that point, I felt like, wow, we're really lucky that because we're Mac people, we get to run our own network and do our own thing. And I don't know how it was at IDG, but in any case, it was kind of fun to feel like you didn't have to be so beholden to the corporate powers. I guess we should sort of set the scene about what was going on with Apple and the Mac, say, that 93, 94, 95 period. So from a magazine point of view, it was great times for us because the issues were fat. I say the episodes because we're all podcasters now. The issues were fat. If you look at those moldy copies on your shelf, you'll notice that at that time period, they were, you know, 200 and 300 pages, and didn't say that fat. But that was kind of like heady times for the magazine and for the Mac, but in a weird way, because the Mac was in a niche space. So it's what are your memories of what was going on in the Macintosh world? Let's just say, you know, 93 to 95, something like that.
I love I'll always be associated with Frog Design. They were still making Frog Design Macs. I mean, the old design studio where it was a lot of like square corners and like linear vents. And I still, there are a couple of Macs that I have held on to. One is my Mac LC, chiefly because it's still just such a cool shape without being really designer-y about it. I mean, it's for a computer that is designed to support the weight of a like 80-pound Trinitron 13-inch color monitor and give you access to a disk drive slot. It's just such a beautiful, elegant thing. And you pop off the top and you get to see the entire circuit board and everything you ever need to get access to. And that was so that's why I still have a big, big soft spot in my heart for Frog Design on Apple products. And I kind of miss it. It was probably the last era, and remember this is where like the slide was starting to happen. Mm-hmm. Like Steve was gone, Scully was. You start in the 90s, Scully got to run the show.
It was Scully and then Emilio, and then it was this long series of dip-changing CEOs.
Spindler. Don't forget Diesel Mike. Well, Spindler.
That's why we're talking about like the curve as things go down. You have Scully, who is like a very able CEO and marketer, who is not really that sophisticated when it comes to being like a tech CEO. I still think the Newton message pad was really, really cool, ahead of its time, but really, really cool. Way too expensive, but cool. Way too expensive to develop software for, but cool. But you can see the little decisions that start to just pull one brick after another out of the foundation until you get to like 96, 97, where, okay, the next, we can take out one more brick without it collapsing, but it has to be the right brick. I mean, people forget exactly how close to the edge Apple was, like right before Steve came back in, and how long it was taking them. I have such great memories of every single wrestling match that Apple was having over how to build the next major, huge, revolutionary rewrite to the entirety of the Macintosh architecture. And things got so bad that you remember Apple Inc.
Sure.
Which is the like sort of like Apple's in-house like private version of CompuServe, which was there for their in-house email and also how they talk to developers.
User groups too.
Oh, sorry, and user groups. So it was like the conduits to and around Apple. So I signed up for a developer account. You get this form to fill out, and part of it is, oh, well, you're going to need like an app. We're going to give you an Apple Inc. Email address. Give us your first, second, and third choices for usernames. And so I obviously, okay, well, they're definitely not going to have an Otko. I really want Andy I because at the time I was at the kick of I want to be Andy I everywhere. And so that's three. So I put, okay, an Otko last because I'm definitely going to get that. Second choice would be Andy I because I still have one left. Number one will be Andy because that's obviously been taken, but who knows? It's going to be Andy I or an Otko. May as well have the third one. And I'll be darned, I got Andy at AppleLink.com. And so now, which I thought was cool, what I found out very, very quickly after that became active was that the reason why Andy at Apple Link was available is that a very, 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 very senior Apple executive at Apple Europe who had Andy at Apple Inc. and had recently left the company. So that's why when they deactivated him, that became available, but nobody updated their address book. So for years during the 90s, I would get all of these group emails of extremely confidential internal stuff. Including like I would look in my two different apps for getting mail, and my regular Andy Anatko citizen journalist one had Apple announces stunning progress being made on the new Copeland operating system. We might even release it early. And then in the other inbox, Andy at Apple Inc. It's like, okay, here's why printing won't work and will never work unless we sacrifice the ability to make and create subdirectories, which in itself is buggy and crashes the entire operating system. So that's, and meanwhile, you have all these divisions who are fighting each other, giving me, I'm not making any of this up. Again, you know, Andy, you're one of the few people who's, you're not a fanboy, and you really tell it like it is. So I, as an Apple employee and manager, I need to get you this vital information so you know exactly how things are going on. Now, of course, you can't use my name, but you should know about how things are going. And I would nod and take the phone call and take my notes and then go into my inbox and find out that, yeah, that guy actually is trying to undermine this other manager and get his staff and get his funding. It was really, really bad. So, yeah. So my answers would be frog design and incredible backbiting and infighting at Apple.
Were you able to use that stuff in any way? Obviously, you couldn't say, well, I read in these secret Apple emails today. But
I covered myself. I actually consulted a lawyer after realizing I couldn't. If I let this go for 2 or 3 weeks, that's fine. But if I keep the line open, and so I did send them two different emails, and then finally a certified letter saying, oh, by the way, you think that Andy at Apple Link is this guy, but it's not. You should change it. So I never actually quoted anything that I saw because I wanted to keep that pipeline open. Mostly it was used when I needed to come up with an expert opinion on something. I suspect that there's going to be a bottleneck with printing in Copeland. And if anything, that's going to delay it even further. I know that everyone's saying this October, but I have a feeling it's going to be much later than that.
Jason, do you have fond memories of either or Macs or particular things that were going on in the Apple universe at that time?
I remember, I mean, that was in the earliest days of getting Macs on the internet. When I started at Mac User, we couldn't get on the internet from our desks. We could check our email with like Quick Mail, but we could not actually do like internet mail or internet thing. In fact, some people had modems to do dial up, and I could do dial up to the UC Berkeley.
I think I had a modem. I might. Yeah. I did some modem reviews, so I probably did have some modems in my office.
Yeah, so I had a modem that I used to do dial-up to, it wasn't even PPP, it was SLIP. It was the beta SLIP service at UC Berkeley. I was one of the beta testers of that. And that let me check my like internet email and things from my desk. But it was the earliest days, and I remember when we got internet on our LAN so we could run like email and web browsers and things like that, and that was kind of a big deal. And so it was the early days of the internet and the early days of the Mac getting on the internet. These were the days where Adam Engst, of course, who does Tidbits, he wrote a book called The Internet Starter Kit.
Giant book.
Apple,
enormous.
Apple agreed to put Mac TCP on a floppy disk in the back of the book. And that was a big deal because Mac TCP was literally a control panel you had to install on your Mac so that you could be on the internet. Mac didn't ship at that point with the internet out of the box. But if you bought Adam's book, and you had to buy the software, you couldn't even download it. You had to buy it from Apple, or you could buy Adam's book. So it's incredible, like kind of largesse to Adam, but I think their idea was they wanted people to be able to get on the internet, and this was an easy way to get that software in bookstores and things like that. Bought Adam a house, which is good. Good for Adam, good for Tanya, good for Tristan. But so that's my big memory is that was going on. And then speaking of John Sculley, like the Newton, the last Macworld Expo I didn't go to for decades until the very end was that one where the Newton was announced because I was just an intern that summer. So I didn't go. I was the only one back at the office when all that was going on. So the Newton was happening. And then, as Andy pointed out, it was this quest for what was next on the Mac because it was very clear that the Mac in the latter days there, and you know, in the late 90s, that the Mac OS was just too old. Like it was they were doing things. They did System 7, which was such a big deal to do multitasking and all of that. But like with Copeland and then maybe shopping around, we had a B-Box in at Mac User. I remember Jeff Pittelkow, our lab director, he had a B-Box. And that was a PowerPC machine that ran that operating system. And then eventually we were able to dual boot. I remember dual booting my Power Mac 7100 into BOS in the offices in San Francisco, the Mac User offices at that time. And so there was a whole lot of that of like, what is going to happen? So it was funny because it wasn't just existential dread of like, is Apple going to go out of business? But it was also like existential dread of like, can the Mac even survive if Apple survives? Like, where are we going to go? There were rumors that they were talking about licensing the Windows NT kernel, at which point the Mac would become like a value add layer on top of Windows NT. Super weird era. Lots of questions about whether we were going to make it out at all. And of course, in the end, what happened is that Steve Jobs came back to Apple. He killed the clones, which immediately dried up all the ad revenue that was pouring out of the clone makers to Mac User and Macworld, which directly led to Mac User and Macworld merging. And then he obviously kind of, that was part of the deal to buy Next Step and make that Mac OS X, which was a great deal in the end. But that was the resolution of that existential question about Apple was, oh, we're gonna basically buy Steve Jobs back. Everything else led from that.
So I've so much chambered up here based on what you guys have said and what I wanted to talk about too. It's like, oh my God, so many things. But let's start back with the internet because Jason and I were kind of the internet reporters was our beat together. Totally. And I will tell a story that I have never told because it always sort of embarrassed me. But at this point in time, I think I should be way beyond that. So I remember sitting in a big staff meeting at Mac User and Jim Akin, who was an associate editor there with me, was sitting around we were all chatting before the meeting. And Jim said, I saw this thing called Mosaic. And it's really cool. And you can click links and you can go from one page to another page. It's on the internet. And I'm going to look into that because that's really interesting. And I remember thinking, this is some point in 93, but I don't remember exactly when. And I remember thinking, I think when I get back to my desk, I'm going to find out what the hell he's talking about. And at that point, I feel as if I should already have known what he was talking about, but I did not. And so I went back to my desk. And so I guess I should credit Jim Akin with starting being on the half of the internet beat at MacUser, because I got interested and I was like, oh my God, this thing is amazing. And, you know, started building HTML pages once I figured out how that was done. And then Jason and I, long about 1994, I guess, we were still in Foster City when this started, we created the world famous, the membership benefits, speaking of member benefits, for people who were subscribers to MacUser, the famous internet map, which was on paper.
Yes, the internet the internet roadmap.
Yes.
Somebody at Ziff Davis, like PC Magazine or something, had done this premium that was like some sort of roadmap idea, but I don't even know what it was. Whether it was an internet roadmap or something else, but the idea was you could print a map and then you could put it in, and the internet was big, so maybe we should talk about the internet in the early days. And I think maybe their thing, whoever that was, we didn't even use that as a base. We came up with this idea for the internet roadmap. It was so much work. And we get, speaking of Adam Banks, Jeff Duncan, who was went on to be like the managing editor of Tidbits for a while, was this guy that I knew because he and I did Intertext, the fiction magazine on the internet that I'd been doing since I was a junior or senior in college. And Jeff lived in Seattle, and I met him on the internet, and he is a super smart technical guy, and he wrote this web crawler. So what we ended up doing is, like, Shelley and I would come up with pages. The idea was that every spot on the map was going to connect via hyperlink to another spot. So we had a lot of Yahoo pages, right? Because that was at the point where Yahoo was at Stanford, and they had that, they had a hierarchical, basically, structure for all the web pages on the internet. So we could use that as the skeleton and then branch from there to, the idea was you could actually kind of like look at the internet, like literally this is all that's on the internet, which was not that far off. I've got to say, not that far off, but it was a funny concept about like, here, how do we get to the cool sites on the internet? But the rule was they had to connect. And then, yeah, Jeff Duncan wrote this thing where he was basically our fact checker for that one and the second one we did, where he was, you know, his little robot would, I mean, he basically built Google as a script, as a, like an Apple script or something, or maybe it was a Perl script, but he basically built Google just for our internet roadmap, just to make sure that all the links worked and you could follow the links and all of that. It was a wild idea. It was a huge amount of work. It was way, as coming at it from somebody who ended up as editor-in-chief of Macworld, I look at that and I'm like, that was a lot of work for
a
subscriber premium. That was not like, that should not have, that's too much work for something like that. But it was an amazing, I still got like three or four
I
of them.
Too.
It was an amazing piece of work.
And physically, it looked like the old travel roadmaps that you would carry along when you were driving. And we agreed, I think, on top level categories, and then had all these sites that spun out from them. And we took Jeff's work, and I think we would, you know, there was some editorial management of it, certainly, because we would say, well, we know these to be good sites. We know these sites to still exist, because you'd find things that would just die, because it was 1993 or 1994, and internet sites did not have any longevity necessarily. I don't know. I do remember sitting in the first meeting when Maggie Cannon told us we were going to do this thing and just being really skeptical, because it just seemed like such an enormous project. Not that it was a bad idea or anything. I was just like, how in the hell are we going to make this thing work? And Jason's right that Jeff's technology made it even possible, although we knew that the minute it was going to be printed, it was going to be out of date in some fashion.
Yep. Sure.
Yeah, we did two of them, right? So
yeah.
So you and I did a lot of internet stuff. I did more like networking hardware. I remember stacking up a lot of routers and what they called ARA devices, Apple Remote Access devices, back in the day. And somehow I was doing all of this networking hardware stuff. And you were out explaining the web and parts of the internet that people had never heard of to the wider world. And that's kind of what we did. And then the other thing I had chambered up beyond the sort of internet in those days was to get us into the clone wars. And when Apple first allowed and then pulled back the clones. And one of my proudest purchases during my time at MacUser, I knew I was in the big bucks because I bought myself a fancy tricked out power computing clone tower.
Oh yeah,
and
me too.
I had one.
And see, to me, what was interesting, because I'm from and have returned to Austin, Texas, but I was living in the Bay Area at that time. And power computing was based in Austin. Some ex-Dell people were there, as were a couple of the other clones. And so it felt like And I was super homesick while I was there at MacUser, and I would go home every chance I got. But it always felt like there was this sort of weird connection between the Bay Area, where Apple was and where the center of technology, Silicon Valley was, and Austin, where they were making all these upstart clone machines that were either going to destroy Apple or make it great. We didn't know which at the time. And I think on my desk at MacUser at some point, they had sent me a Supermax clone because, you know, they made hard drives for a while and then they made clones. And I had that, and it was just like this insane time. And the revenue thing, what a lot of people probably don't know about the way advertising revenue works. So at MacUser and Macworld, we got all the advertising from the software vendors and the accessory vendors, the peripheral vendors, and then the clones. And then the other thing, in addition to Apple pulling the clones back that hurt revenue, was there were these things called catalogs that were sent out, the Mac Mall and the PC Connection and the Mac Connection. And a lot of the people who were buying ads in the magazines would just buy ads in those stupid catalogs. And so all of it kind of worked together to do a lot of harm to the printed Mac magazines long before the internet made print obsolete.
Did you know that actually one of the reasons that those magazines could even exist in the form that they existed was because of postal regulations? This is a really ridiculous fact, but it's true that there's a different rate if you're sending a catalog that is just commercial than if you're sending a magazine. Magazines get a better, or at least in the day, probably still true, get a better postal rate because it's just like how you can send books for cheap. It's like there's a built into the law idea that distributing journalism is favored by the postal service. And so even the catalogs themselves, Mac Warehouse and Mac Mall and all of those, would buy like 20 pages in the back of magazines.
Yeah.
Because they could reach, and then they'd reach a new customer, and then they put them on their list and they'd send them a catalog too. But it was, the catalogs were really expensive to mail out compared to being in the magazine because we got a better rate. And that propped up the magazines, I think, for a very long time. They did make occasional attempts to, insert some bogus content in their catalog to claim that it was a magazine, but that never really penciled out for them either because they would have had to pay for content. But it was a really funny thing, and it was so weird because in those days, the percentage, the amount of ads was so variable, oftentimes because Mac Mall would come in and say, we want 15 pages in this issue, that we had to build an entire section, both Macworld and MacUser, actually, and probably every computer magazine, had to build a collapsible section of the magazine that would only ever appear if they got a lot of ads, because you couldn't go below that threshold. And so we had at MacUser the Minifinders database, which was literally...
Oh, my God. That was so many pages.
It was a FileMaker database of all past reviews with little capsule versions of what the reviews were and their ratings, which is kind of a cool idea. And the idea was that section only ran when we needed to puff up the editorial percentage of the magazine to avoid the higher catalog rate. And so sometimes at the end of the month, they would be suddenly like, oh, they brought in 20 pages. Minifinders needs to be 8 pages or 12 pages. And whoever was in charge of it, there was a guy, I can't remember his name now, but there was like the Minifinders guy. He did the database and he would do the layouts for that. He would generate those exports and they would get imported. And then other months they wouldn't come in and be like, no Minifinders, or 2 pages of Minifinders, and then it would collapse. And it was all this totally weird artificial thing based entirely on percentages because of not wanting to be a catalog instead of a magazine. Let me tell you, in the later days, Shelley, after you left the magazine industry, that was no longer a problem.
Right.
We never had a ratio problem on that side ever in the last 15 years that I worked at a magazine. But in those days, you did. You had to. There were a lot of ads that would come in, I think, because the catalogers saw some value in just sticking a mini version of their catalog and having it ride along with a legitimate editorial source, because it would save the money.
It would affect the features well to some extent too. More Minifinders, because that was a big chunk of pages you could add or subtract. But occasionally you would be working on a 6-page feature and then be told you had 12 pages, or the reverse, which was much worse. And so you would have these elaborate feature charts, or you would have I know, we're going to have a 2-page sidebar, basically, and you'd have to come up with stuff, or you'd have to go and get art commissioned or take it out. And you'd, you know, it was worse, like I say, if you thought you were going to do a 20-page feature and you had to do 12, because it wasn't so much the writing, it was all the pieces you had to put in it, whether they would be sidebars or sets of charts or things like that. And, you know, that's really labor intensive, because I can't make that happen sitting up late at night. I have to work with the art department, and I have to, you know, get those things created and the spreadsheets made and all that kind of stuff. So let's talk about clones a little bit. So I guess before the ultimate demise of clones, like when clones became a thing, you know, I for one thought it was exciting just because there were different form factors and they were never as pretty. They weren't frog design, obviously. They weren't as pretty as the Mac, but you did have what Windows people had, which was the ability to use much more configurable machines, and the clone makers were using, you know, were providing cheaper products and that sort of thing. So from a consumer point of view, and even from the point of view of somebody who was reviewing stuff, it was interesting to have those options. But what do you remember about the clone times?
I just remember that it was very, very different, because any time that Apple came out with a computer, it was the residue of a lot of deep thought, whereas, at least until things got really bad near the end. But when you talk to clone makers, oftentimes you really did talk to, we had a spreadsheet, we decided that here are the specs and here's the design of the machine based on, we decided we can get this sort of power supply from this source, and we sourced this style of case. A lot of the stuff was really, really variable. There was no middle ground, which kind of was surprising. The hot stuff was either companies that were kind of fly-by-night characters who wanted to be able to sell you something really, really cheap because there weren't any really, really cheap Macs, or companies that wanted to sell you super, super hot, super, super fast production machines because Apple didn't at the time have anything that was super, super fast. So it was doing, the clone market was doing pretty much exactly what people might have thought that it was going to do, meaning that any computer that Apple was not exhibit any visible interest in making, a clone maker would step in. Who remembers the 96? Could be the 96 Macworld Expo, in which the president of Power Computing showed off the legendary zippered case that he promised. Said, "This contains a Mac laptop that runs it with a 68030 processor in it that we're not allowed to make because of our agreements with Apple." and who knows, we might have had, like, you know, his Oscar Mayer Lunchables in there for all we knew, but it did make a point that Apple wanted to at that point Apple was trying to get control back and saying that no, we want to make this stuff, we want you to make stuff that helps Apple become stronger, we don't want you to make stuff that forces Apple to compete for hardware sales. So that ended the way that it was going to end.
Jason, what about you? Or did you, now, were you reviewing clone machines at that point for Mac User?
I'm not sure. I was high enough in the food chain to write reviews of systems, but I bought one, and we were all writing about them and doing the news about them. I think I probably wrote more announcement stories than anything else.
Yep.
But because I had a Power Tower or Power Wave, right? Power
right,
Computer
Power
Wave, I think, is what I had. And that was the truth of it, right? Is that they were able, perhaps because of their nimbleness, perhaps because of all that kind of Dell DNA that they had, they were able to turn around really quickly and get those systems shipping with stuff that Apple hadn't even shipped yet. And it, to the point where there was another clone maker, Daystar Digital, that was specializing in high-end clones for designers, and it built the first multiprocessor Mac, and it had a whole, like, hack where it had multiple processors, and then there was a plugin for Photoshop that would let you send certain tools to multiple processors at once, and Apple basically bought it from them, basically licensed that technology, and the first multiprocessor Apple Macintosh was using Daystar Digital's APIs and, like, the whole thing. So it was a weird position where Apple's laptop stuff was strong and they did not license the laptop designs. But on the desktop, you know, they kind of were all over the place, and they, you know, the first the PowerWave, although I think I never had this, one of its boasts was that it was a Mac that you could get the old style expansion cards and the new style expansion cards, both. It had like PCI slots and new bus slots, which was a big deal because you had like, if you invested in old cards, you could still use them, but you could also use the fancy new cards. They built like a daughter card or something that converted them all.
Yeah, I don't think I had one but I remember that being a thing.
I think it was impractical in the end, and it's sort of silly that they did it, but they did it, and Apple didn't do that. So it was a super weird time. It was obviously great for the magazines, because when you have multiple clone makers, that's a whole lot more advertising revenue, because they're trying to drive that. But I think it was great in that perspective. I think from the perspective of Steve Jobs coming back, it's like the worst thing in the world, right? Because it not only was it bad for Apple's Mac sales, but it was also bad for Apple's appearance and like pride that basically they couldn't make a good desktop Mac. They had ceded it to the clone makers. The people who were most excited about Apple stuff were buying these clones. And so I get why Steve Jobs wanted to shut it down, but it was seriously a death blow for the magazines. And it is no coincidence that was one of the reasons why Ziff Davis and IDG decided to stick their Mac magazine businesses together and kind of cut their losses. And I should say, within 6 months, I'm sure they realized they had made a tremendous and horrible mistake, but it was too late.
I think that was a weird time too, because Steve Jobs, who eventually became the hero and this lauded, amazing person from the point of view of both technology and just business in general, at that time, if you had been in the Apple universe for a while, it wasn't clear that he was going to be the savior of Apple, or whether he was going to kill it rather than save it, because it was too uncertain. And then, of course, the thing that we loved, the thing that we were making our living doing, these magazines, were being hurt by it. And we weren't so much thinking, I wasn't personally thinking, well, he's going to destroy the clones, which is specifically going to destroy the magazines, but just so much uncertainty and so much, what is the future of the Mac going to be? And can companies rely on the Mac as something they want to write software for, build accessories or peripherals for? It was just incredibly uncertain.
No, there was that in that 97, 98 period, definitely. If you would talk to somebody about where they thought it was going to go, the conventional wisdom, not even like a possibility, the conventional wisdom was that all of the professional publishing accounts, which were essentially the core outside of education of Apple's business, were going to switch to Windows NT. Like everybody, and of course, there was an entire Windows NT sales and support infrastructure gearing up to make that happen but with Adobe and Quark Express, pushing along with everything else, just saying, we're going to do this, because they didn't want to get stuck on a sinking ship either. And it was, I had people tell me, if you care about your career, you need to go work for PC Computing magazine or something like that. That was at one point after I went over to Macworld, the CEO of Macworld was seriously considering whether that magazine needed to be refashioned into something that was more of a publishing industry and Windows NT kind of thing. We were mandated to do a feature story at one point that was basically like how to make your Mac more compatible with all the Windows things that are around you. It was really dispiriting too. It was rough. But what were we going to do? And Jobs, in hindsight, he had the right idea, which is basically like, I need to stabilize this business. I need to create some products that make people actually think that Apple might survive. And all in the background, the thing that we knew they had to do, which was a new Mac OS. They had to do that. And so they did that in the background while they were doing the iMac and the iBook and all of those things in the foreground.
But that was delayed so many times. I mean, we heard about Copeland long, long before. OS X was a very, very long time in coming.
Yeah, and Copeland, they went, they showed it. I've got I think I finally threw it away. I had a t-shirt that was the hands-on experience with Copeland at WWDC, which is like, you can try this OS. That will never ship. Never ship. And then when they shopped around and they ultimately bought Next, it's because Copeland wasn't going to work. And that's the thing that I was going to say. The people looking from the perspective of now, people who never knew the era before OS X, don't remember that like when Steve Jobs came back, OS X didn't like ship. Like OS X wasn't really usable until like maybe 2001 or 2002. It wasn't until 10.1 came out.
I think it shipped in 2001 and it wasn't usable to 2002. I remember because I was
2002. Yeah,
I was trying to write a book about 10.0 and we were trying to use it and there were whole sections that could not be written because the software didn't work. And I had a co-author, and I just remember calling him up and saying, I can't do this section because it does not work.
Yeah, 10.1 was when it was even barely arguably usable. I remember writing a story in Macworld about that, and that was the end of 2001, and that was the apology release where at that time they charged for updates, and 10.1, there was no charge. It was like, we're so sorry. Here it is, and this is usable. But like that was 2001. Jobs took the reins in 97. The iMac came out in 98. Like, so the iMac and the iBook and the new PowerBook design, like the titanium PowerBook, all of these computers, and we think of sort of like Jobs' return, new computers, and OS X as happening simultaneously, but if you look closely, you'll see it was not simultaneous. Like the OS X thing, which is why Jobs came back, that didn't save Apple. It was all those hardware moves that were computers running OS 8 or OS 9 that saved Apple.
And the iMac, as inventive as it was as a computer that you used on a daily basis, I mean, everything from the hockey puck mouse to the operating system was, you know, was a dicey proposition. And you could say, well, this is really pretty and it comes in colors, but is this really what Steve Jobs is going to do for Apple? Are they going to go anywhere beyond that? Is OS 10, is it Mac OS 10 ever going to happen?
Well, they had to play to their base as they rebuilt. There's a legion of people that have faith in Apple and they like Apple stuff, and the bad thing is that they personally identify with Apple. So Apple is like sort of a proxy for their own selves. So one of the biggest components of the rebound for Steve Jobs was to make sure that you keep your base very, very, very happy. And the iMac was exactly the sort of thing that was engineered to do that. If anything, it was nostalgic for as futuristic as it looked. It really was, let's create something that was as weird on its year of release as the Mac was in the year of its release, let's release a computer that doesn't use any of the media that is popular at the time, that can't use any of the existing peripherals at the time, that will use a brand new bus standard that is just getting launched, but basically is going to promise everybody that nothing you own, none of your printers or networking devices are going to be able to plug into this thing. It's an all-in-one, so that's compact, but it's cool, it looks great, and it'll have design influence, and to be honest, it probably took people a day or two to realize that it doesn't have a floppy drive. But this was the sort of thing that would get people to realize that this is not, after slipping into a trajectory where they were selling really weirdly shaped, underpowered, boring beige boxes, and having a special model number, you know, send Centrona 4112/A7 just for sale at Sears Roebuck's. That's part of what everyone needed. And we also forgot that it's easy to forget that there was that really dispiriting for me 2 or 3 years where I had to stop necessarily recommending Macs to people because the old version of the operating system, the version they've been building on since System 6, it was so old-fashioned. And if one app had a fit, it would bring everything down in an immediate crash. You couldn't really multitask. Memory management was pitiful. When you spent some time on Windows and you realize that I didn't have to restart once in 7 hours. I didn't have to restart this thing once. That's how bad things
were. Oh, yeah. People don't remember, like, your Mac would just lock up multiple times
a
day. Multiple times a day. There was that period. I remember sitting in San Francisco at Mac User, which puts it very clearly in, like, 96, 97. I remember very clearly sitting in that cubicle forcing reboots all the time. Like, people don't know now, like, just how bad and unstable OS 8 systems were. It was a disaster. It was not good at all. It is funny though, Andy, I'm struck by you saying, because it's totally true, the iMac was so incompatible. And there were so many reasons for it to fail. And putting USB on there, like, it was good in the sense that they were clearing out the old, but like all your investment in old peripherals was just going to get swept away and you're going to have to buy new ones. And it did work for a lot of reasons. But I just was struck by the fact that 20 years later, I have an iMac on my desk right now, made this year or at the very end of last year. So 20 years later, it still has the exact same port on it. I know it's not really, it's much faster and all that, but literally, if I took that mouse from that 20-year-old iMac and I could plug it in. So as weird as USB proved or was at the time, it was a pretty great move, right? Because I still have USB-A ports on most of my computer. Actually, all of my computers have USB-A ports right now. Don't tell anybody. And so isn't that amazing that it was weird at the time, but 20 years later, they're still around. Yeah. So I guess they made the right call there.
Remember that USB was an industry standard. It's not as though that it was a good call.
To USB and the whole standard too, that I find it just as a computer trivia thing more than anything else, like the same port works 20 years later. Yeah. Really?
But what I'm at is that there's probably a better, this is an institutional thing at Apple where someone would say, wow, that's great. I agree. It definitely should have like a couple of USB, these new USB ports, in addition to at least one Apple desktop bus. We're basically picking you up and throwing you into the future. And by the way, the rest of the industry will catch up with you in 2 years, but for 2 years, that's going to be a lonely time. And you're going to have to spending $100 to $200 on an external floppy drive. That's on you. And spending an extra $80 to $150 on an adapter that will let you use your old printer with the printer you've been using successfully for the past 6 years with this new machine. That's also on you. In addition to like the drivers that will make it work, that's on you. So I just think that there could have been a much more elegant way of doing that that created inconvenience for Apple instead of creating inconvenience for consumers.
I remember those days as being forced to do something I didn't want to do, not because I was in love with the ADB port or the SCSI port or whatever, but just because it was going to require a tremendous amount of change. And Apple wasn't really holding your hand down that path. They were just throwing this new thing on your desk and saying, you know, adapt or die, basically, which I guess was what was going on inside of Apple as well.
But, and ADB definitely needed to go, no question about it.
Yes, absolutely.
Just like SCSI needed to go. But there would have been more elegant ways of doing that, rehashing stuff that I'd stopped talking about in 2000. But
well, I think larger issue. I mean, look, the iMac was successful. I think the idea was because I actually for the 20th anniversary, I looked at all the like letters that people wrote to the editor for that release to Macworld, and what struck me about it is that that was not a product for the install base, and that really even the install base was mad about it for good reasons, but it was not a product for them. Like that product was intended for people who wanted to buy a computer and probably didn't have a computer or didn't have a recent computer and wanted something very simple to set up. And so I think it was okay that it didn't provide any compatibility bridges because that old stuff did need to die, and that the people who were most likely to have investments weren't going to buy that computer. So it's probably going to be okay. But what I would say is I wonder to this day if Apple culturally learned the wrong lessons from that decision, which is just to shuffle everybody off to the newest port and kill the old ports outright, maybe misunderstanding kind of why those very specific decisions were made for the original iMac. I don't know.
Yeah, I think that point's well taken. And I think we've had over the years, if you dug around and thought about it, there are any other instances in which that has happened. And some where the success has been less obvious for Apple. I mean, obviously the iMac and USB and all those particular choices they made at that time made sense. But there were other times when Apple said, all right, we're going to do this. And people got left behind. So one more sort of a trip down the nostalgia train, and then I'll let you go. But I wanted to talk a little bit about Macworld Expo, because in the 90s, when we were making those big fat magazines, another thing that was fairly healthy was the Macworld Expo, which did not just happen once a year, but happened twice or more a year. They were in San Francisco, they were in Boston, they were in New York. And I met most of the people I knew in the Mac industry outside of Mac User at those events. And so I'm wondering if you guys have any particular memories from the fat days of Macworld Expo in the 90s.
Macworld Expo was, it's got its start in Boston. And so even when I was in like high school, that was like a big deal to like make the trip out from the suburbs into the city on my own. to tromp around these two. And this is when Boston didn't have really an expo center. So it was split up beyond to two smaller expo centers that were separated by like a long-ish bus ride in August in Boston in summer. And so it was really like sort of a... it was sort of like an initiation test every single year. If you're really a Mac fan, you will put up with this for 4 or 5 days because it was like Burning Man, only with fewer chances of actually seeing art and culture because you were in Boston in 1986. But it was a thing. It was especially cool like after becoming a part of Mac User, because they would like because the World Trade Center in Boston used to be, I mean, there was no subway stop nearby. You would have to walk about a mile through like undeveloped land with no shade, no nothing to get to
over a bridge. Yep.
to get to like the actual city. Since there was plenty of space, Mac User would like rent the dirt parking lot, the dirt covered lot nearby, and erect a huge tent with air conditioning in it. And that's what made the last several Boston Mac Worlds very, very, very positive experiences for me. But beyond that, it was the old days of trade shows before the internet, where this is where you get to see people, and this is where every company who had something to announce or release, whether it's Apple releasing an iPod or just an independent developer showing off like a debugging utility, that's when they would go and release it, because that's when everybody would have the attention of the world's like Apple market and all the writers and everybody. And it was like, and what I miss most about it is that I had this excuse to simply go to San Francisco, spend 4 or 5 days, and just hang out with 20 or 30 friends of mine that I would only ever get to see, really, at Macworld Expo. But yeah, it was a carnival, it was a festival, it was a tribe of people. You knew that everybody was a mutant who was kind of like your kind of mutant, and I kind of miss them.
Yeah, every time, even after I left Mac User, I could come back to San Francisco and once or twice to Boston and see all my people again. And that was an excuse. I have to go and cover Macworld, or I have to just go and be in San Francisco. And it felt different because when I was at Mac User, I would actually take cabs between World Trade and Bayside, because I would be going from meeting to meeting. I felt really important and I knew that I would get my expenses paid. But I also do remember a couple of times when it was raining like crazy and I was going from World Trade to Bayside and was just miserable. And like, I wish I had planned better. But once I left, coming to San Francisco every year was a highlight, and it was like being a tourist in your own city, because I had lived in San Francisco for 5 years, and I sort of, not only did I just know where things were, I really felt I knew my way around, I knew who I wanted to see, and I knew where I wanted to go, and it was kind of the best of both worlds. And I also, I mean, to be honest, I had like lighter responsibilities, because I was usually doing a few stories, I had a few freelance gigs, I'd get briefings and stuff like that, but when I was working at Mac User, there was usually a lot more going on, and there were more obligations to go see every vendor of an accessory or an Apple remote access server or whatever, and you'd have to go and say hi and ask them all about their products and say that you would consider reviewing it, but you weren't sure whether you were going to review it, and then you had, you know, Eddie Awards to go to and all those sorts of things. And so it was not a hardship by any means, but it was really different than when I was doing it as a freelancer.
I have two Macworld stories. One is that my first day on the job, I mentioned that I got hired in January of 94 before I finished grad school. My first day on the job, I didn't go to the office. My first day on the job, I went to a hotel suite in downtown San Francisco where a rented tuxedo was waiting for me to do the Eddie Awards.
Ah, yes, the Eddies.
And that was my first day on the job was extremely unusual, because I went to the Eddie Awards where we handed out Oscar-like statues, except the gold man is holding a Mac, depending on what your year is, a Mac SE or a Mac Classic, I think it got updated to. I have one near me right now that I got much later on.
Now, there was one that showed up on eBay last month.
Yes.
I remember, and I did read.
I am aware of where
that it has already been bought by a very, very nice or worthy person.
Yes.
Was that?
Yes. I did not buy it, but it has a good home. I can't tell you where that home is. I will reveal that home might have at one point had six colors in its logo too. but it wasn't me. Because I already have, I took one of the spares when I left Macworld. I was like, I ran this awards for 10 years. I'm going to take this thing.
I remember quietly asking you that, why, when your guys are clearing out the office, if you come across an extra one, you know, I would find that was like the only like tchotchke or memento, even as a freelancer. Like, I will consider that my lifetime achievement award. Like, you did nothing at MacUser to earn yourself something, an award as pretty as this, but you were there for a long, long time and you'll probably be dead soon. So let's just make sure we can say that we gave you one, or that you can say that you got one. So.
Lifetime Achievement Award.
That would have been my tchotchke of choice as well. So a year or so ago, Jason and I were both asked to speak at Sal Segoyan's Mac Automation Conference, and Sal brought his Eddies with him. And I got to hold two of them. And I had held one before, but I had never held and been photographed with two of them. They're quite heavy. Much heavier than I would have expected them to be.
They are very. You can do some curls with those.
You can.
They are heavy guys. It's absolutely true.
Who sculpted that? Because I'll say that
I don't know.
That always impressed me, because sometimes you'll see, like, even when they say, "Oh, and this is the General Motors is the winner of the prestigious GD Power Award," and it's a piece of Lucite on a piece of wood that you could probably have made at Office Max on it with a 3-day wait. This was actually like a. Something that above and beyond, like, whatever you can use it for advertising purposes, you would like to think that when this 3-person software shop breaks up, that there would be a fight over who gets to keep the Eddie statuette, because it's a very impressive object.
No, it's made with all of the, I think, detail that you would make any other kind of custom statuette, like an Oscar. It's not cheaped out at all. In fact, at one point at Macworld, they wanted me to cheap out and like, can we do a plastic thing? And I was like, no, no, we're not gonna. When we stop giving out the statues, we'll just stop giving out the statues. But I'm not gonna cheap out on that. So that was my one story. It was weird. There was a suite where editors could go, and I put on my tuxedo, and there was like they ordered up room service and stuff, and I discovered what an expense account was. I was kind of appalled. Like, they were ordering all this food in, and I was like, this seems wrong somehow. But I didn't know, and I just was happy to be there. And so that was my first day on the job, and it was so basically the first day of Macworld Expo. And my only other story I'll tell is when I was working for Pam Pifner, and she was the editor-in-chief at MacUser at that point, one of the things that I did, so she would have her schedule, right, where the editor-in-chief of MacUser, she's going to meet with all the big vendors out on the show floor. And she wanted me, it was my, I think maybe this is the same year, she wanted me to walk the floor with her. So, or maybe it was the next year when she was editor-in-chief. She was editor-in-chief like a year or two later. She's like, you walk the floor with me. You'll meet the people. I'll introduce you because you're going to be doing this, you know, the news section, and you, everybody needs to get to know you. It very rapidly became she was so far behind in her schedule almost immediately that my job was no longer follow Pam around and she'll introduce me to people. My job was to go to when she was supposed to meet with somebody and say she's running and how late she was, and apologize and maybe talk to them, but basically say she will get here when she can. And then I would go to the next one, and I would, now how late is she? I would go back to her, see how late she was, go to the next one. And that was my, I think maybe first, maybe it was before she was EIC even, when she was just a senior editor. That was one of my trials by fire for trade shows, was literally I was the guy who would say that meeting you think you're having now with a senior Mac journalist, you're not having it now. You get me, and then she'll be, and then, around lunch, there would be that moment where she's like, you just got to tell them that I'm not making it there. And I'm like, oh, God, right? And so then I would have to go and say, like, yeah, she's not coming, Chief. Sorry about that. So that was, yeah, good times.
And,
there
was no iPhone that you could use to keep in touch with her or vice versa?
No. Just running around on the show floor. And, yeah, that was good times. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Good times. Well, gentlemen, I think this has been a really fun trip down nostalgia lane, but let's get back to reality. Go back to the present. I'm sure we all have podcasts to make, things to write on this brand new fangled machine called the internet. So I will say thank you so much to Andy Anatko and Jason Snell for joining me on the members-only edition of Parallel for 2018. Thanks, guys. This was so much fun.
Yeah, it was. We have history, and soon we will be history.
It's true. Yeah. There's three relay hosts who can list Mac User Magazine on their resumes.
I know.
So
that's crazy.
We got that going for us.
Not sure I want everybody to know that that's how far we go back, but I don't think there's a choice because
only members.
The only members.
Thank you, members.
I'm perfectly pleased with that. As I say each and every time that the topic of how long like I've known Jason comes by, I relish in saying he taught me how to boldface things in HTML. That's how long we've known each other.
No, Jason just always says to me, whenever he introduces me on a podcast, he's like, we've known each other 20 plus years. And I just go, yes, I know. I'm aware.
And then we both just turn into dust and blow away in the wind.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Exactly. Well, thank you. This is one of the benefits of membership of Relay FM, believe it or not. Thank you so much for listening. You can find more episodes of The Parallel at relay.fm/parallel. And more episodes of the member podcast. Well, you know where, because you're already listening. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.